Blog Talk Radio.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. Wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine. I'm gonna teach you to fly. We've only tasted the wine. We're gonna train a cut dry. Wait till your charms are ripe for these arms to surround. You think you've flown before, but you ain't left the ground. Wait till you're locked in my embrace. Wait till I draw you near. Wait till you see that sunshine place. Ain't nothing like it here. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come. Come the day you're mine. Oh, from the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started.
I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content, we'll have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must fail to conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I'm not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. Yes. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. Yes. I have a dream that one day, yes, this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. That my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope, and this is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims cry. From every mountainside. Let freedom ring, to be a great nation. This must become true. So let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
This is the last word, August the 30th, 2013. I'm Michael Lawson, along with Thomas Fortenberry.
Hello, sir.
Well, how was your birthday?
An absolute surprise.
You still didn't bring me back my Reds.
Thank you. Oh, Reds is still at the house.
That
is correct.
Still at that
but
house.
It was a good movie.
It's being held hostage.
But hey, how about this?
I can give you two little children. No? No good? How about a little dog? Well, he's 7 pounds.
A little dog?
Yeah. My grandson's little dog. No?
No.
Well, This has been a great week. We're looking at the breaking news. The president just spoke. And Syria, beware. He is coming after you.
Yep.
Right now we have someone on the phone here who I'd like to introduce. Hello, who's this? Hello? Paula.
Hey, Mike. Michael, this is Robbie Wells.
Robbie, how are you?
I am just fine. You said 3:15. I'm here.
I know. I'm prompt as always. Did you, are you in Fayetteville?
Actually, right now, I am still in Charlotte. I will not be leaving for Fayetteville till late this evening.
Okay. All right. And we also have, let's see here, where is that at? Where is she at? Trying to see here. Oh. Okay, we also have on the phone here.
You know, you know, hey, Michael.
Yeah, Miss Grace Dean Galloway.
How
are you, Grace?
You, Michael? Oh, great. Well, I'm great. I'm really perturbed at what is going on in Syria. Very perturbed.
Well, that's the question that I wanted to ask Robbie, since he is our presidential candidate. Mr. Wells, what would you do in the Syrian situation if you were President Obama?
Well, first of all, my thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the victims there in Syria in the middle of this civil war. A lot of lives have been lost. What I would venture to say is that even though we see major atrocities happening in Syria, I do not believe that we are in a position financially as a nation to go into Syria right now militarily. I do believe that we need to sit this one out. We need to let them sort this one out on their own, even though there is some atrocities going on. Because, again, we've got to take care of our own backyard before we worry about anybody else. We've got 39 million Americans living in poverty and 149 million Americans, which is basically half our population, that are existing on low income and relying on the federal government for some form of assistance. We've got over 20 million Americans that are unemployed, another 25 million that are underemployed. We've got 800,000 veterans that are homeless right now. I truly believe we need to start spending these taxpayer dollars right here in the United States and taking care of our own backyard. We're giving away $50 billion a year in foreign aid. If you think about why we're giving away this money in foreign aid, it's to buy friends. Really, it doesn't buy anything. So I would sit this one out. There's atrocities everywhere. There's atrocities here in the United States, and we've got to start taking care of ourselves. So let's take care of ourselves first.
Chairman Lean, what do you think about that? What would you do?
What would I do? I agree that there are atrocities. I agree that we should not be involved, but maybe for a little bit different reasons than what Robbie is talking about. Financially, I know that we can't afford it. I know that. But I think we have to go beyond the financial, and we have to go into the moral aspect. Morally, this is a reprehensible act by the Syrian government. But here's the big however. If they are so immoral, and if they are so inhuman as to use chemical weapons on their own people, what is to say that they won't do it on our boys and girls that we send into harm's way? I don't feel that I could take the responsibility. I mean, I'm saying if I was president, or if I had the power, if I had the ability I am not saying that I could send our young men and women into this kind of harm's way. I could not do it. I could not do it.
Well, I think you both have given compelling reasons, but let me give you a third reason. One is the president he told the people, the Syrians, he told Assad, do not go more than what you're doing now. Since World War One, no one has used chemical weapons except Saddam Hussein, and you saw what happened to him. And this is a red line. And the second thing is, the War Powers Act gives the president 90 days after pure hostile approved. So the president does have authority, and he does have money. So that's a red herring. That's dark. The problem is, it must be after what happened in all those African countries where hundreds of thousands were killed and we did nothing. And you can ask President Clinton, who has talked about that. He's left it in his memoirs. He said that's the most terrible thing that haunts him to this day. That didn't stop it. And he could have.
Michael,
a moral issue. Now, a moral issue is that the president now already drew the line. So what is Russia, what is Iran going to say, what's Syria going to say when this president does not do anything?
No, I'm not saying he shouldn't do anything. I'm saying we don't send our men and women into harm's way.
Well,
if you want to start
that,
firing IBM missiles
right.
from the you know, from the ships,
well,
not a problem. I don't have a problem with that.
I don't. He laid a predicate that was unbelievable. And there's more to this that we know that the public is not going to know, but the Congress, if they came back from wherever their lazy butts are at and acted like a Congress instead of taking almost 7 months vacation to address this, the president would not have to do this on his own. But they don't want to give him the satisfaction that he is right. They can't afford that. And they don't want their name or their fingerprints on anything. So the thing is that the president, I believe, should do this. The Secretary of State said there will be no ground troops. The president said about 50, a half hour ago, there will be no ground troops. We know that Assad's brother, he's a general in the mountains, is where the strike of the chemicals came from. So the predicate is already there. Robbie?
Well, bye. Michael, if I could intervene right here and just say, number one, the War Powers Act, that is put in place strictly if there is a direct threat against people of the United States. Now, I venture to say that what's going on in Syria is in Syria. The only way that you would see us in harm's way is if we did stick our nose into this conflict. Number two, if you read USA Today this morning, you would see that Russia and Iran have sent naval ships into the area. In fact, Russia has sent two warships into the area. And, of course, we've got five in the area right now. And their mission is to keep us from firing on Syria. I don't think that people truly understand the seriousness of this. This could actually cause, if we do actually fire a missile on Syria, this could actually trigger World War III. So you've got to be very, very careful.
Robbie, I have to interrupt you because you are wrong when you said that only is in the time of war. It's in time of hostility. Let me read you the entire thing. It says,
I didn't say war. I said when we were in direct, in a direct threat. The United States citizens are in direct threat.
No, it doesn't say that. It says under the War Powers Act, the president has 90 days after introducing troops into hostilities to obtain a congressional approval for that action. It has nothing to do with a war or a threat to America. Any hostilities. So the thing is, and every president since Kennedy has done just that. So the threat that the Russians are sending two ships there is just like Letterman said. Will they make it there? We don't know. So the problem is, there's no way in the world the Russians are going to attack any American ship. They can't afford it. They don't have a good military. Everybody knows this. You know, they're saying that the Russians have nothing going for them but mouth. But mouth. They have not been directly into any hostility since they got run out of Afghanistan. So, Madam Chairman, it's yours.
Yes. It's mine. Okay. Well, my line is no boots on the ground. That's my line. Zero boots on the ground. Mainly right. Because this man is a maniac. I don't know. I would hate for him to be turning weapons of mass destruction on our young men and women. That
Absolutely.
Would be unconscionable. Then I'd get pissed off. Listen, then I'd have to go out there and take the son of a gun out, okay? And you don't want some crazy Asian American over there. You don't want
well, we
that.
Well, we want Mr. Galloway upset, so, you know, we can't have that happen.
No, you just can't do that. I mean, so that's my position. My position is no boots on the ground. I think we should send a message to this man that he cannot continue to do what he's doing. The argument that I hear people make all the time is, well, no one, who left us in charge? Why are we policing the world? Well, I don't think it's policing the world. I think it's a moral responsibility. We don't want to get into the war. We don't want to start another war. We don't get involved in another war. But, you know, the thing is that somebody has to stop a bully. Same thing with Hitler. Nobody stopped the bully. So look what happened there. Okay?
Absolutely.
And we cannot let that happen. See, you know what? Let's extrapolate that information and let's bring that to the United States. We've got bullies here in the United States in our U.S. Congress. We've got bullies here in the United States in Raleigh. Okay? We've got bullies right here in the United States in North Carolina, in the governor's mansion. We've got bullies in the budget department named Art Pope. We have bullies right here. Somebody has to take a stand against these bullies. So if we are going to present our arguments and if we're going to say, oh, my gosh, look at the terrible thing that's happening in Syria, then these very same people that are saying, look at the terrible thing that's happening in Syria because this man is a bully and is mean, I hope to goodness that you all are taking the same sense of anger and the sense of righteousness, and you are going to stand up against the bullies right here in the United States, in Congress, in Raleigh, and in the governor's mansion.
And ma'am, let me say, I agree with you, but I think that we should be looking here first before we start looking elsewhere. We've got so many problems right here in the United States. And let me just say this, too. All of these conflicts from Desert Storm, 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, now Syria, possibly Iran in the future, all of this comes because we are entangled with all of these countries in the Middle East because we get a lot of our oil from over there in that part of the country. That is why part of my platform is to become energy independent right here in the United States. Does that mean strictly oil? Of course not. But we get 25% of our oil annually from the Middle East. My goal is once I do become president is to become at least 25% oil independent in my first 4 years as president so that we can no longer have to do bad business with these countries that harbor terrorists and support terrorist activities. You know, we just need to leave them alone, let them do their thing. We've got enough resources right here that we can take care of ourselves, and we need to start taking care of ourselves.
Well, you're absolutely correct, Robbie, but the problem is that if you have the same Congress that Barack Obama has, you can kiss that platform goodbye.
Well, Michael, and if I may, I want to take it one step further. I agree that we have to take care of our own family, but we are not. This is not what we are made of. We're not made to be so self-centered that all we care about is ourselves. That's not us. That is not America. Americans have always taken care of each other. We've always taken care of each other in terms of not just Americans, but the family of man. We have taken care of the world, if you really want to think about it. Who sends money? Who raises money and sends them out on missions, you know, to different parts of the United States? When you talk to any church and they talk about a mission, where are they sending these people? They're sending it to Haiti, to India, to Africa. You know, and I actually have sometimes a bone to pick with them because I say, well, dadgummit, why don't you send a mission to Appalachia, for goodness sakes? Or why don't you send a mission down to Georgia? You know, why don't you send a mission down to Mississippi? So, yes, we do. And I see what Robbie is saying. I really, really, really do. I really see what he's saying, that we should be taking care of our own. I think we should be, but I don't see why one is mutually exclusive of the other. I think we can do both.
And if I could say this, you touched on something very, very important right there when you said the churches and the different groups out here that actually do charity work. That's where a lot of the aid should be coming from for everyone. I don't think it should so much be coming from our federal government. Again, our federal government should be helping the people of the United States, the taxpayers right here. We've got so many problems right here in the United States. And again, you touched on another good thing. If we put our troops in harm's way, all those troops have moms and dads. They've got wives. They've got children. And a lot of them wouldn't be coming back home. So we've got to do everything to protect American citizens, and that includes our troops. And you're talking to a guy that actually did serve in the Army National Guard, so I understand. You know, when you talk about war, when you talk about conflict, you're talking about American lives that are going to be lost, and lives on the other side too. I don't want to see anybody have to die.
Well, you see, I agree that Robbie, but I was in a shooting war, Vietnam, and what we need is to have the United States Institute draft again. If we had a draft, we wouldn't even be having this discussion. But as Donald Rumsfeld said, they signed up, didn't they? That's what he signed up, didn't he? So he's got to go when we tell him to go. But you see, if it was your son or daughter or my two daughters, no way that would occur. So this is the problem we have. We need a draft like I have in Israel, service to the country, and then get a reward as education or something like that. This would not be a discussion.
We've got to clean up our own mess that we've got in Afghanistan right now. And a lot of people don't know this, and I try to bring this out anytime I get a chance to speak. So I'm getting a chance to speak, so here I'm going to bring it out. We've actually got a living prisoner of war right now in Afghanistan being held by Taliban forces. His name is Bo Burkle. And Bo Burkle has been held by Taliban forces since June 30th, 2009. That's over 4 years. It's going on 5 years now that this young man is being held. Our current administration actually knows where he is. Now, here's what I'm going to say. I don't know why the current administration has not gone to get this young man, but if our current administration is not able to get him by the time this term is up, and if the good Lord willing, and if the people see it my way and I am elected president in 2016, then on January 20th, 2017, my first day in office, I'm going to be taking steps to bring this young man home. Right is right, wrong is wrong. Right doesn't hurt anyone. And the thing about it is, this young man could be your son, Michael. It could be my brother. It could be anybody that serves in the Army right now. It could be them instead of this young man. So, you know, when we start talking about what we've got to do to right this republic, I think it comes down to two things. It comes down to love and to serve. We've got to be willing to love each other, whether it be our family, our friends, total strangers. We've got to be willing to love this country. It's like a school teacher. She shows that love to all of her students by serving them and making sure that even though she's underpaid and overworked, that she's going the extra mile. The love of a mother, a single mom that works two jobs in order to serve her kids and provide for her kids. So when you start thinking about the love of the military, when they serve this country and lay it on the line, the greatest love that any man can have is that he lays his life down for his friends. And that's what our military has done. So when you start talking about conflicts, we've just got to make sure that every I is dotted, every T is crossed, and that it is constitutional as well.
Believe that what you're saying is absolutely correct. But, you know, it's just like every shooting war. When the first bullet is fired, everything changes.
And though, Michael, when I was in Vietnam, I had the great distinction of being shot at by both the Vietnamese and the Americans.
They wanted you out of there.
Well, you know.
I don't want to touch that one with a 10-foot pole.
Go ahead, Thomas. Go ahead. Please.
Bergdahl here. Bergdahl has been in captivity since 2009, and they all know where he is, and he's being held, and he's been part of the negotiations that they've been having with the Taliban, is why he's not. He's the high-level trade that we're trying to set up when we transfer the entire government back, and they are requesting we release our Guantanamo Bay prisoners in exchange for him. But they're trying to work out a deal with the government because the Taliban doesn't want to cut out of the Afghan government, and they're demanding to have a seat at the table, and that is this whole high-stakes negotiation. So he is part of that, and that's why they haven't gotten him back yet, is he's actually in those negotiations right now. That's why they've been doing this.
Okay, so that explains that. Well, but as I was saying before, when the first bullet is fired, everything changes. And the problem is that we can say what we want sitting out here. I'm sitting out looking on my deck that's being built, extension. If I'm sitting in the Oval Office, I'm getting briefings from every Tom, Dick, and Harry that's in the administration of things that I didn't even dream, you know, dreaming that the aliens are watching us from outer space. I mean, you know, so when we can't say what we're going to do, we can say what we think we'd like to do for the Oval Office. And with that, Robbie, what is your platform on immigration?
Well, what you see going on right now in Washington with the amnesty bill, I just don't think it makes very much sense because it doesn't really protect American citizens, and it doesn't really protect the aliens that have come into this country. What I would like to see happen, number one, we do need to secure our borders, not only with Mexico, but with Canada as well. Once we have these borders secure, which, you know, we basically need to quadruple our border patrol, I would also ask the bordering state governors to have their National Guards units to actually back up our border patrol agents. They have to go and drill anyway throughout their career in the Army National Guard, so why can't they just go drill down towards the border? I know this, if I was part of a drug cartel down in Mexico and I came up trying to come through and terrorize American citizens, which that does go on right now, by the way, down on the border in some of our bordering towns with Mexico. But if I was a bad guy and I came up and I saw the Army National Guard, I saw these Border Patrol agents, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to go home. I'm not going to try to go through them. So That's the first thing I would do. The second thing that I would do is I would implement a plan called Service for Freedom. A lot of these illegal aliens that we have in this country right now, millions of them as a matter of fact, they came here because they were coming from impoverished nations in third world countries down in Central and South America. And they were coming for liberty, and they were coming for freedom and a better way of life coming here. The problem is the process to become a citizen here in the United States can become very costly and very expensive financially. And these people were not able to do it, so they came in illegally, and it was very easy for them to come in. Now, here's what I would say to those that want to come in that are impoverished like that. Let's let them serve for their freedom. Let's let them serve this country. Earn a wage while they're doing it, by the way, but actually serve this country, whether it be in the military or serving city government, state government, federal government, in some sort of roles, you know. Whatever the case may be, there's all sorts of jobs out there that we could put a lot of people to work. But let them serve for a total of a five-year plan. During that 5 years, let's educate these people on what it truly means to be an American, what it truly means to be free, what it truly means with the history of this country and our founding fathers, what they set in place for us. Let's teach them, if they do not know the English language, let's teach them the English language. And then at the end of that five-year period, they've gone through that process, let's grant them their citizenship, because it's really unfair to both sides right now. And I think that this plan would actually be fair to everyone, and at the same time, people are actually working to gain their freedom and gain their citizenship. So that's what I would do.
Well, you know, Robbie, that's two things. One, we don't have any National Guard troops. They're all over in Afghanistan and guarding in some places in Iraq. And when they come back, they closed up half the daggone military bases. So they need to get out. And if they get out, how are we going to afford to pay them with a job? They'd be an unemployment person. Because this regressive party that's in Congress now does not want to create jobs. All they want to do is 41st time vote against Obamacare. They haven't created one job, and there's plenty of jobs that could be gotten here. But don't you think that Americans should get those jobs first?
Well, and I completely agree with you. And my plan, if you click on my website, which is www.robbywells2016.com, and that's Robbie with a Y, RobbyWells2016.com, you can actually look at the game plan, which is my platform, and every phase of it. In fact, I do want to bring back millions of jobs to this country that we've lost in the past 15 years. In fact, we've lost 4.5 million in the past 15 years strictly because of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which I will be pushing to repeal. At the same time, we need to move to a fair trade system. And what that basically means is goods and products coming into this country, we need to raise the tariff on those goods coming from other countries so that we can actually compete to make that same good right here at the same price. That's what's going to bring all these companies back. And this is very personal to me because when I was in high school, I lived in Graniteville, South Carolina. Graniteville was a mill village, and you had the Swint Mills and the Graniteville Mills, and there was the textile mills. They made the denim for your blue jeans. And thousands upon thousands of people were employed in these mills. Well, thanks to NAFTA, those mills closed up, and they moved south of the border down into Mexico. And all of my friends from my high school days became unemployed. Of course, so the suicide rate in that little town went through the roof. But you have homelessness as well, all sorts of bad things that shouldn't have been taking place. And we call that progress. I don't call that progress. We've got to make sure that we take care of the middle class here. And that's one thing about the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party says they love the middle class and they want to take care of the middle class. Well, listen, I want to take care of the middle class by putting them back to work. There's an old phrase, you give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day. You teach him to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime.
Well, I agree with that. But Chairman Leem, you are very much involved in these things, especially with the military. What do you think?
Okay. There, gosh, boy, I tell you what, that is, this is a big bite here. All right. Yeah, we need to put our young men and women who are coming back home. We need to give them a job. We need to be able to do all that. Yes, absolutely. And all that great and wonderful rhetoric. Okay. And I'm not, Robbie, I'm not saying that what you're saying is rhetoric. I'm saying this is in general. This is what everyone says. People beat their chest and go, yeah, we need to put our young men and women, our military, back to work. But then they do nothing about it. Then nothing gets done about it. And that's a horrible thing, horrible travesty. We cry all the time that we are sending our factories overseas, but then they don't want to buy American because it costs too much. You see, this is where I'm saying, guys, you need to put your money where your mouth is. If you say you want to buy American, if you say that you want American economy to succeed and to grow, then buy American, even if it does cost you a little bit more. If you say that you really feel like you want that, you know, that our vets need to be rehired, need to have a job, then hire them.
Let me break in real quick right there on my plan on vets for kids, because you are so right. These veterans, when they come back, we've got to put these veterans back to work. I've actually got another plan that's called Vets for Kids. You know, we sat back and we watched this horrible tragedy back in early December up in Newtown, Connecticut, where Sandy Hook Elementary School was on the spotlight because a psychopath went in there and decided to shoot the school up. I'm the type of person, when I see a major tragedy like that, number one, I want to step back, take a pause, and see if there's anything that I can come up with my advisor that will actually help the situation. It absolutely broke my heart because I was an educator for 20 years on the high school and on the college level. And I came up with this plan called Vets for Kids, which will take care of three problems in this country. Number one, it'll take care of every American's Second Amendment right to bear arms. Number two, it would take care of every child in every school across this country and make sure that they are protected while they are in school. How? By taking our unemployed veterans and putting them back to work after they've gone through a screening process and a training process, but putting them back to work in these schools guarding the children. And who better to guard these children than these veterans who have laid it on the line for you and me and have taken an oath to protect the people of the United States of America. It may not be a perfect plan, but it would be a plan that would put over 500,000 veterans back to work across this country. And my plan also does not include any taxpayer money to do it.
Well, Thomas, you have something?
Oh, well, there's so many things. That's just the militarization of our schools, and I'd rather not have all military schools. We have a few here, and that's plenty. I don't need to turn our military back on our shores and militarize our cities and our schools. That's anathema to the American way. That just horrifies me. But anyway, so to the economy, one of the problems has been, ever since the 80s, you know, we have gutted the economy by outsourcing everything. We broke down all the labor laws, all the protections, and all the wages, and then we gave companies actual tax breaks if they could go abroad and find cheap labor markets. So they did. They went everywhere. That's when we've got, you know, everything made in everywhere from, you know, Saipan to go to Philippines to, you know, and they constantly keep moving to a new market every time they exhaust one and people start rebelling or whatever, or people find out that they have, you know, a prison sweatshop there and they move to the next market and exploit them for cents on the dollar. But none of that is actual market. It's not, it's true pirate capitalism, but it's not a fair market in any way, because all you're doing is exploiting a modern source, almost like slave labor. It's just a modern source of cheap labor. So you don't have to have any laws or oversight or funding for it. And secondly, they also allowed companies to outsource all of their revenue and basis of operation so that they can claim to all exist in a single, you know, P.O. box in the Virgin Islands or wherever and not pay taxes in America. Both of which are wrong. This one's, you know, gutted the economy, which is why they keep having to raise taxes on real people since corporations don't pay any taxes. And that's why our wages and our jobs are falling and nobody has employment because all of our jobs are, of course, overseas in third world nations. It would be very simple just to restore all reality here and companies hire and pay workers here. That would be the solution.
And you know, there's one other thing, Robbie, you mentioned the Second Amendment. Now, I guarantee you, everybody listening to this show, I would say 90% of the people have never read the Second Amendment. So I'm going to read it for you. The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution is part of the United States Bill of Rights. It protects the rights of people to keep and bear arms from infringement. It was adopted in December 15, 1791, along with the text of the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment was based partially on the right to bear arms in English common law and was influenced by the English Bill of Rights. This right, described by Sir William Blackstone as an auxiliary right supporting the natural rights of self-defense, resistance to opposition, and the civic duty to act in concert in defense of the state. In the 19th century, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the right to bear arms is not granted by the Constitution. Neither is it in any manner dependent upon the instrument for its existence, and limited enforcement of the Second Amendment to the federal government alone via the 1875 Crunchak case. In the 20th century, the federal court construed that the government could limit any weapon types not having a reasonable relationship to the preservation or the efficiency of a well-regulated militia via the 1939 Miller case.
So there you go.
It states you do not have the right as an individual to bear arms. It says you have the right to have an arm if you are in a well-regulated militia. You have the right to protect the state. It does not mean self-protection. It does not mean the individual. So everybody
actually,
that says this is
actually
wrong.
Actually, Michael, if I could interrupt real quick, I'm going to give you the exact quote. It says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So it does say that the people can bear arms and it shall not be infringed upon as well. But it does say that a well-regulated militia. Now, that it actually has two parts to it right there because you've got the militia and you do have the right of each person to keep and bear arms as well. And here's the thing. I believe that Michael, you've got the right to protect your home. You've got the right to protect your property. You've got the right to protect your family from invasion, from someone trying to come into your home if they're coming in unlawfully. And I believe that everybody does. I guarantee you the people up in Newtown, Connecticut, now that they've gone through this tragedy, and see, here's the thing. Newtown, Connecticut is small town USA, and there are thousands of towns like this across the country that are saying, oh, this will never happen to us. But it did happen to Newtown, Connecticut. And if you go up there now and you go to those schools, you're going to see armed guards at those schools. If you go to the schools where Barack Obama's kids go to school, you'll see that armed guards guard those children. The same thing with the governors of each state and so forth and so on.
It's not armed guards. Hey, guys, it's not armed guards. It's the Secret Service, man. It's a little bit different.
Right. So, you can say this and you can interpret it. I mean, just I'm looking at you read the fourth paragraph down for where I read, because I'm looking at it, and it does not say that. It says, if you read the whole thing, it's if you read one version was passed by Congress, and it said a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. It doesn't say being necessary of the security of a person's property. It says the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. That means you, if you're supporting, protecting your state, you have the right to have a gun in a well-regulated militia. It does not say you can protect your property. It doesn't say that.
Right. Well, dang dumb it. Now I've got to give up my Uzi. Shoot.
That's right.
Well, as a it has a
right
to raise arms against
the king. Correct.
And they were forbidden from it. So
right.
They said, hey, mm-hmm. you have the right to protect your state.
That's right. But it doesn't say the right to protect yourself. It says the right to protect the state. Not everybody has the right to self-defense. But it doesn't say that.
If somebody is jumping you, then of course you have the right. I mean, you'd be stupid not to defend yourself. But it doesn't
Absolutely.
Mean that you have to outgun somebody. It doesn't
That's
mean
right.
that if you know you got a .22, I got to get a .45. And if I got a .45, you should get a .350. You know, .57 Magnum. I mean, it doesn't mean that at all. It means defend
right.
yourself. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can punch somebody out. It's okay. You know, if somebody's trying to mess with you, I mean, I don't like violence, but that's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm saying. Defend yourself.
The thing that people always forget, the first words in this says a well-regulated militia.
Absolutely.
A well-regulated
Absolutely.
Street or a well-regulated mm-hmm. house. It says a well-regulated militia. That's the first three, four words in this text of the Constitution. So
well, let me.
Go ahead, Robbie. Go ahead.
If I can interject, I think that you're on the opposite side then from Vice President Biden, because it was Vice President Biden that just a few months ago went
to
on
get a shotgun.
Yeah, that his wife.
Yeah, but that's
making
you know,
sure that his wife
he,
has a gun.
No. That's not what he was saying. I mean, and that's unfortunate. Joe Biden. I love Joe Biden. I seriously do. I love him. But, you know, I guess what he was trying to do was to say, look, don't get a daggum semi-automatic. Get a freaking shotgun if you really need a gun. If you really want a gun. Get a freaking shotgun. You know?
That. Everybody has a right to have, but they don't have the right to have a .38 special. A snub
they
gun.
Don't have this or semi-automatic.
That was created so you can hide it in your pocket and shoot somebody. So we're talking about the rights of a well-regulated militia, which in this case in the state is our National Guard, which, Robbie, you are a proud member of.
So, Robbie, you can have all the guns you want.
I was a member. I am no longer in. And, guys, let me just tell you this. I was in very briefly. I volunteered in 2006 when I was 38 years old, went through basic training out in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, in the month of July. Are you there?
I didn't know. I know that.
During the months of July and August, I went through my basic training in Fort Sill, which is basically the desert. So I found out very quickly as a 38-year-old going up against 18-year-olds, even though I was in great shape, they're still 18, and I was 38, guys. So, you know, my hat is off to these young guys that and ladies that lay it on the line every day for our freedom. And, you know, my hat generally does go off to them.
Well, you know, Robbie, you know, you have to be congratulated for even trying to do that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Well, may I add, I did graduate with honors at the top of my class, so I was real proud of that.
Okay, Robbie, tell me the truth. Who did you push off the bridge to get that honor? You can tell us. We're just the most famous here. Come on, Robbie.
Well, let me tell you, the most awful thing that I think that I've ever done in my entire life was during the training when we had to go through the gas chamber. Goodness, that was all it was. But they make every soldier go through that so they will actually know what that is about. And talk about what's been going on over there in Syria. I understand. So, no, I'm just like you, ma'am. I do not want to put any of our troops in the harm's way like that.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. And, Michael, this has been wonderful. I do have to run. I wish I could stay and talk longer.
And Robbie, I want you to tell me, I want you to come on next week and tell us how everything went and give us a little more of your platform. And it was great talking to you today, and I'd like to have you on next week. Is that possible?
Michael, that is absolutely possible. I'll be glad to do it. And, Michael, let me just say this to everybody listening and to you as well. I wish everyone a very happy and safe Labor Day weekend. May God bless you, Michael. May God bless all the listening audience. May God bless these United States. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Grace. And bye-bye. That is our doctor in the house. And she will be back with us.
Let me tell you what.
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Robbie Wells, our independent candidate for president.
Oh, yeah, well, he did a good job.
I'll
tell you. You got to be good. That's right. Right now, we have a young man on the line. And who is this? Hello?
Is it me, Michael? Matt Newton.
Matt!
Is it
how
me?
Are you?
Hey, Matt? Hey. Hey, Michael, I'm great.
I thought you were going to call in later, Matt.
But
that's
well,
all right.
I was calling to listen.
No,
but now I guess I'm on.
Huh? That's fine.
That's
I was calling
fine.
To listen to the program, but I guess I'm on.
Oh, okay. Well, you stay right there and you listen.
Okay.
I'll get right back to you because there's a couple of things I got to do. So we have, you know, and this is something everybody interprets the Constitution the way they want to read it.
Yep.
I mean, it's like I got to, you know, they never read from the very beginning of what it says. They have to go down in the bowels and find two or three words that might change it, but it doesn't change it. This is so incredible.
We get these guys, you know, these religious conversations we've had with people before, you know, they'll cherry pick like one half of a verse from this part of the Bible and from that part of the Bible to make a point.
Yeah.
And it's always a problem when you actually have the full true text.
Well, and the thing is that I would like everybody to go to, you know, it's, you can go to www.http://:// Wikipedia, Second Amendment.
Yep.
I mean, that's all it is.
Or you can go to U.S. government.
U.S. government. And
government
let me see how many lines down is this. We're talking about one paragraph, two paragraphs, three paragraphs, four paragraphs, and then you go three or four or five or six lines. That's what they are quoting. But they never, say, they always read it backwards. They say, the right of a person to bear arms with a well-regulated militia. No, it doesn't say that. It says a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state.
And people also forget, you know, this is one of the things about paying attention to history and being in politics and everything else. You know, we see how things get spun and done. And one of the deals is, you know, the NRA was formed.
The NRA, what are they? NRA. That's
the
acronym
National
for
Association of Holding a Musket Over Your Head.
Oh, okay. All right.
Cold dead hand.
Okay, a cold dead hand. Okay.
But it is an organization formed by the gun manufacturers.
That's correct.
Of America to increase sales. That is its purpose. That's why it was founded. And so if you look back in history, you know, people in the 1700s, 1800s, they weren't sitting around going, what does that
Second Amendment say?
And
half of them couldn't read.
I have the right to have a rapid-fire musket.
Right, rapid-fire musket. Yeah. Boy, wouldn't that make a difference? Yeah.
So that wasn't the issue. It became an issue only recently.
Right.
Because it was a campaign to change the dynamic of the conversation so that they could increase sales. Because, you know, that's what they do. That's what their job is. And they've done a good job. I give them that. But, yeah, people need to go read for themselves.
Yeah, and why are we so, you know, oh, wow, we're Americans. We don't want no part of that. But, you know, every you read it more and more, this is exactly what the English Bill of Rights says.
Yeah.
Do you see them with guns? Do you ever watch Law and Order UK?
Yeah.
These cops, when they want gunfire, they have to call in the special unit.
Yeah.
And they talk to the people. Guy's a cousin. You know he's the killer. He said, you want to come with us now?
Mm-hmm.
What? Do you want to come? In the U.S., they be shooting those two guys.
Yeah.
I mean, here, no.
Over here, that's what, yeah,
you got to go.
Slow creep here. You know, used to, we had very few armed guards. At most, they would have one little pistol.
Right.
Right. You know, my dad, growing up, back, even when he was a deputy, they had the little bitty 38s and stuff. Then they started getting the bigger and bigger and bigger guns.
Long nose 38.
Well, you know, now that it's funny, the creep of things, because, you know, they introduced.
Creep? Are you talking about Rumsfeld? No. Nixon's creep.
No. Right. But the slow creep of things, because in the 70s they introduced, because, you know, they thought it'd make a cool TV show.
Right.
But they introduced the SWAT teams to big cities.
Right.
And the SWATs were specifically, you know, a strategic weapons tactics.
Correct.
Based off of the military.
Right.
And these were the guys that would come in. If you had something so serious going on, like a bank robbery or something with people heavily armed, that the little local, you know, yokel guy.
The little local yokel couldn't handle, right.
Five with his gun, you know, that he couldn't handle. Well, that's when they would call in.
I mean, it's like a U.S. Marshal. You know,
they were the only people allowed, though, to have guns.
Right.
Like rifles,
right.
Like machine guns, any of that type of stuff, and the bulletproof vest, all that stuff. Well, we've seen the slow creep, though, in recent years with the militarization of our police forces everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They have them. They have.
New York, it's like their own CIA. They told the CIA they didn't need them.
Well, look at it. You know, we were downtown all during the convention.
Right.
You saw that the federal government came in, and they bought so much stuff here. Since then, just giving it away to all the surrounding counties.
Right.
We've got entire fleets of
absolutely.
These special carriers.
Well, they say, well, that was one of the reasons that they were going to get here.
Yep.
Because these yokel local sheriff departments didn't have squat.
Right. But the thing is, so you've seen this creep, and it's really disturbing to me because now more and more, like you see regular police that are completely, they wear body armor. You know, they walk around with multiple weapons. They have not just guns, but tasers, but everything else, you know. And in their cars, they usually have the higher-level weapons. They already have the shotguns and semi-automatics in the trunk and everything else. And then they can still call in the SWAT. When you call in the SWAT today, it's like, you know, Delta Force arriving. It's not even a minor step up. It's a major deal. But the problem that is really disturbing is in under the Homeland Security Act, USA Patriot Act, when that was created, it literally militarized our police forces and turned them into a branch of federal government. And they, since then, have been going, you know, ape. And if you looked at news just recently this summer, like down in Texas, where they were using more and more, do you know they use SWAT now to deliver things like subpoenas?
Yeah.
Because
you're liable to get shot at.
You know, yeah, but they literally, they'll have teams go and kick doors in and all to do things like say, you know, you've been served over here. Here's your, you know, your bank loan eviction or what, you know, instead of a, you know, knock, knock, knock on the door and here's your local sheriff or deputy or somebody. No. Now they just have, you know, the black van pull up with, you know, 15 guys getting out going,
and
up,
the helicopter overhead.
Yeah. So it's kind of crazy. But, you know, now we're talking about, you know, constant drones over the cities and everything. You know, it's a slow creep, but it's very frightening. And it doesn't need to be that way. And that's why I was kind of disturbed with this whole argument. And, you know, the gentleman we just talked with, Mr. Wells, echoed it. But we heard it all during the Bush years that, you know, the NRA argument is the answer to guns is more guns. And the way to end violence is more weapons, and the way to end school violence is to arm everybody.
you know, let's have the custodians jumping out with machine guns and the teachers doing barrel rolls with, you know, rocket launchers and stuff.
Right.
And stuff. It's stupid, but it's a real thing, and we gotta worry about that.
Well, you know, the thing is that we have to worry about is that everybody thinks that they have the right to have a gun. There is nothing wrong with that. Nothing. And as we say right here, just listen to this.
Gun control.
And there's a lot of people in this country wanting to do the same thing was here in a kind of conspiracy, see. You take your big international bankers, they want to, masticate the people of this here nation like puppets on a wing. And then when they get that done, turn us over to the communists.
I'm glad they put you on the stool. You look tall and sitting down.
Now I want to talk about another thing that's on everybody's mind today. And that's your stick-ups and your skyjackings, which, if that was up to me, I could end the skyjackings tomorrow.
You could?
All you got to do is arm all your passengers. He ain't got no more superiority there. He ain't going to dare to pull out no rod. And then your airlines, then they wouldn't have to chase the passengers on the ground no more. They just pass out the pistols at the beginning of the trip, and they pick them up again at the end. Case closed.
That's incredible, Arnie. What do you mean?
So, well, that's what we do to the kids. The first and second graders, when they come in, we just give them bows and arrows. But the kids in the fourth or fifth or sixth grade, high school, we give them a rod, and the older kids, they get the AK-47s.
Right. Right.
So who would come into a school
why
when there is a gunfight going on in the school?
Exactly.
Why would you want to come and shoot some kids in the school when they're shooting one another?
Exactly.
I mean, what? I mean, that didn't make any sense to me.
I
mean, you're talking about a war zone.
Yeah.
Now
what could
that was 20 years ago Archie said that.
Yeah.
30 years ago.
Argument, you know, starting to be made, and they did a perfect satire of it. You know, let's arm everybody. Let's
guns. Arm everybody.
When you enter the building, you know,
that's right.
Enter the airplane. But that's
it's completely insane.
And this is the thing. You know, we talked about this earlier. Republicans endlessly attack. They hate public education. You know, they want everything to be private. They want to take all tax dollars away from it and start charter schools and religious schools and all that. They have successfully, in our state, for instance, now defunded teaching. You know, you don't have tenure anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any kind of anything. You just basically are at the whim.
Right.
Every 12 months, they evaluate you and fire you on the spot. And you don't have assistance. You don't have aides. You know, you don't have any kind of help. It's just on your own.
Well,
that's why, as you just did, I got an entire bundle for all of my children. Of requests from teachers begging for everything from crayons and pencils to, you know, Kleenexes.
Did they ask for AK-47?
Well, you know, just the 500 rounds and shell.
Oh.
But, see, this is what gets me. We can't trust those nasty, horrible, despicable teachers that want to teach things like, you know, evolution.
Evolution, yes.
Children.
Mm-hmm.
We can't trust them.
Well, because they teach evolution and revolution.
Yeah. So we don't want to, you know, all these commies, we don't want to trust them to educate children.
Oh, it's by the way, you know, we never did the show on what is communism, socialism.
No,
well, we're going to do it. We'll do that next week. We've got to do the definitions, right?
So you don't want to trust teachers to teach the children. But yet these same people said that, you know, their response to Sandy Hook to Newtown, to all of these, has always been armed the teacher.
Right.
Remember that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Armed teacher.
And they even rolled out a plan.
Right.
Did. It'll cost so much, and we'll send everybody to train up. They don't want to pay for teaching, but they want to pay for arming.
Oh, yeah, well, see, they want that to come out of the funds where they cut all the assistants.
Exactly.
That's just so you'll have enough money in it to arm teachers.
This is my new assistant.
My sister, Smith and Wesson, right. That's my dude sister. I don't need another sister. I mean, if you can't get out of line, I'll shoot you.
Yeah.
You have a point. Hey, you got an AK-47? I give up.
I'd like to explain that to the parent at the end of the parent meeting with the principal. I'm sorry, little Timmy was shot.
Well, yeah.
Because he wouldn't stay in his chair.
Yeah, right? Well, you know, I have to remind you, when I was in Catholic school, I went to Catholic school for almost half my life. And we had this.
Imagine if those nuns.
Well, this is what I'm getting to. This is what I'm getting to. Sister Mary Herbert. Oh, my, in the eighth grade. Oh my gracious.
I can tell the ruler.
And I couldn't stand her, but after my mother ripped off a habit one day, I was some teacher's pet. Yeah, but that's a long story. I'll tell some other time. But anyway, just one time before I was a pet.
I felt fire on my feet.
Yeah, that was it. Yeah, she said. Michael, come into the closet, because that's where she did all the dirty work nobody could see.
Ah.
And when she went into the closet, she had her ruler with her.
Yeah.
And she used to smack you, hold your hands,
yep.
And you hold your hands out, not palm, up, and she hit it on twice, and then she turned over and hit it like that. Yeah. I want you to, I now forget what it was. So the next time,
see you blacked out
the that's pain, the, I, you the plane was so, right, because and it was really bad. It was two hands, so that was four whacks. And she had this ruler called Betsy. Yeah, it was a stick from the street. It wasn't a ruler. She had her ruler, and she had Betsy, which was not smooth.
Yeah.
And that she turned it over, and she hit you with Betsy and the ruler. So after I became the teacher's pet, and my mother ripped off her habit at church. After we came out of church at 10 o'clock in the morning, my mother told me to run, to go home. And she says, well, I didn't dismiss you yet. She says, you're not his mother. That's what my mother said to Sister Mary Herbert. And my mother said, go home. So I lived like, I'm in the eighth grade now. I was 12. So she said, go home. So I ran home.
Yeah.
And I told my grandpa, I told my father, oh, my mother, she's gonna get me in trouble. She's fine. Because I turned around and I saw her shaking her. And a habit fell off. And I said, oh, my
like
God. I said, I'm not going back to that school ever again in life.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, wait till my mother. I said, she was shaking her. And I said, my mother came in about 10 minutes later. He said, well, what happened? She said, nothing. She will not do that again. So, if I'm telling the story, I might as well tell you what happened. Well, I was sick.
I'll have none of that.
Okay. And I was home. I had a strep throat. I was a week out. But, we did our homework, even though I was sick and I couldn't talk and I had a fever. The homework was sent home over the phone, and I did my homework. So, no, not over the phone. My brother was in there. She gave it to him. He was a class below me.
Yeah, I was fixing to say, I mean, you're
school. Yeah. So anyway, I did the homework, and I told my mother, I have to go into school on Friday. This was since Sunday I got sick. So she said, no, you're not ready. I said, no, because I was in the choir, and all the choir, the pastor used to take the kids, all the choir boys and altar boys, to the circus, to the promenade. That was the first day the circus was in town at Ringling Brothers in Bottom Valley, New York City. So I said, I got to go to the circus. You know, even though I always went to the circus that same month in April, because my birthday, my grandfather always took me to the circus growing up since I can remember, and so I always went twice. So she said, no, you can't go. And I cried. And some others, okay, you can go. And I had all my homeworks from Monday to Thursday. And I brought it in. I knew I was going to leave at 12 o'clock that day. So I gave her the note with the homework, a packet in a folder. And she says, give it to me after Mass. Just like that. So I said, okay. So we went to Mass, came out, 9 o'clock. We're in the yard. It was about 8:45. We're playing in the yard. I gave it to her then. Sister Mary, here's my homework and note, absence note. She said, no, give it to me after prayers. So I said, okay. Went upstairs, all lined up. Went upstairs, say prayers, said Pledge of Allegiance. I'm sitting in the first row, third seat. So I get up and I walk over to her desk. I said, Sister, here's my homework and my note. And she takes it, not even opening up, and rips it up. She says, why didn't you give this to me outside? I said, well, you said that I couldn't do it. You didn't want it. She said, no, you're lying. Sit down. And she tore it up.
So I said, well, hey, I don't care. I ain't going to be here anyway. I'm going to with Father to with all the rest of the kids. So then she came over to me. So we went down the aisle. There was 30 of us in the class, 35. And she went down the aisle and asked kids questions on their homework. The first thing you had was math. So it came to me with the math problem. She says, you sit down. Because you had to stand up and answer the question.
Right.
You stand up. So I stood up and she said, she went to the next kid. And she said, it's because all boys in this class. There's boys on one side, girls on the other side. So I went to the next boy and I said, well, sister, you didn't ask me a question. She said, shut up. And she went all through the whole class, and I stood, I'd stand up the whole time. So then, after everybody answered the questions, she comes over to me while I'm standing up. She says, and for not giving me the homework in your note, you're going to stand by your desk the rest of the morning. I said to myself, I didn't say it out loud. I said, I was pissed. So I said, good, I'm leaving anyway. To go to the site. I said, I'll stand it. So I stood up. She asked questions. That we had English, and then we had a break. I started. We had a break. We had candy and cookies. All through. So it came 10 to 11. She's okay, put your stuff away and prepare for lunch. 12 o'clock, everybody's leaving for lunch. So then I'm leaving. She comes up and says, Michael, come over here. And for not giving me the homework and note, you are not going to the circus. I said, you got to be kidding me. So then she left. I walked downstairs. I went home. I told the major, my grandfather, he wanted to go and bring one of his bazookas and blow her up. But I said, no. He called my mother at work, and she said, I'll take care of it. So that Sunday, we all of us had to go to 9 o'clock mass, all the Catholic school. My mother says she's going with me. My mother never went to mass with me except twice in my life. I knew there was a problem occurring. She went with me. I went in the yard and I introduced her. She never met my mother before. I introduced her. I said, Sister Mary, this is my mother. She said, why did you come back to school? You skipped school? Well, you're going to be punished for that. My mother said, no, he won't. She said, I will see you after Mass. So after Mass, we're all coming out in the street now. This is on the church sidewalk in front of the church. I came with my mother. Sister Mary was standing there. And my mother says, if you ever, and she started shaking her, if you ever use those Gestapo tactics on my son again, it will be the last you ever use Gestapo tactics on anybody. And that time, I said, it's time to leave. And my brother said, go home and believe. So that was the whole story. But when I came back to school that Monday, Sister Mary, after everybody seen me before math questions, she said, Michael, come in the closet. I said, oh, my gracious. In the closet. I am dead meat. I will be dead. I didn't want to come to school. My mother forced me to come to school. And my father said, yes, you got to go to school too. I went in there, and she comes. He turns on the light, and she didn't have any sticks in her. And I said, yes, what do you want, sister? She says, how would you like to be the head monitor? I said, the head monitor? No, the head monitor. That was the best job in the whole. Fridays, you got off from school like 2:15 instead of 3 o'clock. And you were in charge of all the other students who would clean the erasers and clean the blackboards, because we had blackboards back then with chalk. And I said, well, she said, oh, that's all right. She said, you just close up your stuff at 2 o'clock, and you go downstairs, and you make sure that all the equipment is ready, the water and everything, for the other students to come down, and you direct them in all the classes how they clean the boards and shake out the erasers. And I said, is that all? She said, yes. I was the teacher's pet. I could have brought in an AK-47 in there, and she said, that's all right,
that's
Michael.
Fine, Michael.
That's fine.
Just don't bring your mother back.
Don't bring your mother back. And I was the teacher's pet. And when I graduated, she says to my mother, hey, I was not top kid in the class. I probably was maybe middle, a little higher than middle. And she said, this is my best student. Long story, but I had to tell it. Yes. Nice story, right?
A good case of parental involvement.
The parental involvement, right.
An issue,
right.
You know, was a little
without an AK-47.
But so, you know, when we get to the problems of, like, our school and things, you know, it is administration. And
yeah.
I think that having a violent school is a failure of administration, naturally. But there are ways around it other than arming it. Right?
You think?
And you don't need to arm everyone to handle one problem. You know, that's overkill again. To use a high start phrase, overkill.
But we also need schools that don't have holes in the walls.
That's exactly right. We need to actually fund these things because you know a little ounce of prevention goes a long way. I was going to read you this real quick. This is news this week out of what is it?
Kosovo.
Houston.
Oh, Houston, Texas.
This is in Texas, but okay. You know, Texas had to recently declare an epidemic emergency, the entire state, because they have measles outbreak.
Oh, well, wait a minute. They can't get any money.
Measles? No, yeah, but look, measles is, you know, almost eradicated in America.
Right. Right? How do they get measles?
We have this thing called vaccination.
Oh.
Again, that's science, right? Well, listen.
Well, I don't believe in science.
This
okay.
Kenneth Copeland, when there's
yes.
reverends on, you know, TV.
Yeah.
We go into mega churches. And his big policy was that he said, vaccines were devil's work all the time. God would protect you. God had a shield over people. So
right.
He forbid.
You mean like the shield for getting pregnant?
Yeah.
Okay.
The vaccine. So he forbid any of his congregation from having vaccinations or their children.
Oh.
Well, then, lo and behold, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
Right.
They had a major outbreak of measles for the first time in the you know, last half of this entire century.
Yeah.
And they traced it back to his church. All the children of his church.
Don't even tell me.
Right?
And they got it from him.
So, but they got it from a member who had traveled abroad and, of course, went somewhere that they had been exposed to it and brought it back. And lo and behold, that's how.
Can you believe that?
The
Lord does work
spread.
In mysterious ways,
and
right?
Even if you don't get it, you can spread it.
Right.
Somewhere. But because they were not vaccinated, the entire congregation comes down with it. Right? Now they created a medical emergency over four counties. But here's the kicker. Solve the problem. All these people are about to die. The kids are very sick. Everything else. They now running free clinic of vaccinations at his church. And they vaccinated the whole congregation. And then that's okay.
What about him?
Yeah, 1,600 people.
1,600 people.
See, that's a little ounce of prevention goes a long way. And a bunch of stupidity will hurt a lot of people. And that's
right.
What I'm fearful, like with all these guns and everything.
Yeah.
If you were just in the beginning, you know, not have the guns and not have easy access to guns, like you and I were talking about earlier, about
right.
People can go to every gun show and everywhere else and just loophole their way into getting any kind of weapon with any kind of, you know, 500-round clip.
Right.
That's the reason we have shootings at schools, you know. And the reason we have measles epidemics in America is because, you know, one megachurch moron decided to ban science. And it blows my mind. That,
mm-hmm.
You know, but this is exactly how it can trickle down, if you will, to use a Reaganism, into society and make a small problem a massive
small problem. All
problem.
Right.
And it's the same way we do this now. You know, we had a guest on earlier, Mr. Wells, talking about the economic disaster that befell his small town, a mill town, when they gutted it and sent all the mills overseas and everybody suddenly out of work. What did he say? You had huge rise in poverty and stresses. People started, suicides went up, everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, you remember during the Clinton years and all that, they had a dramatic, you know, decrease in crime and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And also, people forget, the first time after the Reagan years, when they had devastated the economy,
right.
You remember we went into the huge recession, the worst thing, you know, until the Bush years, the worst recession we've had since the Great Depression. And that was what largely a lot of people say cost Bush his second term, was that the economy was completely destroyed and stagnant, you know. And so they went with Clinton, and under Clinton, we had boom time. We had a rocking economy.
It was a good old time. And so was Bill having a good old time.
Everybody had a good old time.
Not just the rocking economy, but it became the strongest economy the world had ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It became literally historic.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time, you had things like, you know, armed robbery and all that, because all plummeted. Because guess what? People had their own money.
Yes.
This is exactly how a little bit, you know, one little bitty thing can seep out and just disrupt society. And it sounds good if you're like, you know, hey, why don't we give this mill the ability to go and take its equipment overseas and not have to pay health care and taxes and use a bunch of native workers and pay them 20 cents an hour. That sounds like a great deal. The mill worker wins. You say, yay. And then you realize, no, the mill worker didn't win. They all lost their jobs. You know, the corporation won because they moved it overseas.
Right.
But what happened? That entire community then faltered and fell into poverty and despair. And that's the problem here. People don't think about the ramifications of their actions. And it's just like a little, you know, inoculation goes a long way in Texas.
You think?
Because, you know, we're talking about the same state that, you know, they just started, have you heard about this, they're chipping up on the roads?
No.
Okay, well, they can't pave the roads. They can't afford to pave the roads because they have no tax base.
Oh, really?
So now they are using a program that for safety issues, if your roads have too many holes, right, they're going through and they use machines to chew up all the asphalt and spew it out the back and create gravel roads. Because gravel is better than potholes. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
tear up the cars, you know. So they are unpaving roads in Texas right now.
Unpaving?
Yes, because they can't afford to keep them paved.
Well, you got Rick Perry, and Rick Perry says, hey, at least all our people are working. Hello, who's this caller?
This is Mayor Pro Tem Patrick Cannon, and we're trying to keep our streets paved here in Charlotte as well.
Well, I sure hope so, Mayor Pro Tem. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Hope you all are. You can continue with your conversation and just bring me up when the time is right.
Well, I brought you up right now.
Okay, well, here
right
I am.
Now.
Good to be with you.
Right now is your time. Mayor, there are so many things happening in Charlotte. It's almost like you're the president of the United States with all the weight of the – it's just like our present president. You got as many things going on as he does, unless, but nobody's shooting yet, I don't think.
Well, you know, watch out now. But there's a lot of things happening in Charlotte. There's a lot of things happening in the state of North Carolina. And
yes.
We want to make sure we're doing all which we can to kind of you know, gravitate to the issues that are most important to us here and make some changes where changes need to be made.
Right. Can you tell us, well, the first thing I want to know about, what is going on with the airport? Where do we stand?
How do I know you want to ask me that question right off the bat? where do we stand? We stand in the place of an injunction that's been filed by the city of Charlotte to pretty much put a halt on anything moving forward until a ruling of some sort can come back from the FAA. So we are
right.
awaiting what they may plan to do in terms of allowing Charlotte to maintain control of it or to release it to the state to create this airport authority, which is something that I hope we don't allow to have happen because it's just, you know, it's been functioning fine, as many people know already, and we can still operate it in a way that's efficient and effective business-wise if given the opportunity. But we have been doing that all along, so I shouldn't say if given the opportunity because we have been doing it.
Right. Well, the we're waiting then, the FAA, we're waiting for our Secretary of Transportation, former Mayor Anthony Fox, to say yay or nay on it. And so that's where we stand right now, in other words, correct?
Actually, I believe, you know, at one point he was taken away from this. He had to recuse himself away from it as he was going through the process of being selected. I still think right now he is not in the mix of what's going on with the airport. That's my understanding, and this may fall into some other individual's laps to be able to make that decision on rather than his own. In
yeah,
fact,
well,
I think In fact, I think he was always good at that.
Yeah, well, I worked for the federal government for 25 years. Ain't falling in nobody else's lap. That's a lot of garbage.
Well, one thing I know for certain, I mean, it's not like the people there do not probably know what his desires might be. So
absolutely.
In the event absolutely. That it is going to end up somewhere else, I would imagine that that might be advantage Charlotte, if you will, in this case. But we'll see.
Just to get some federal eyes on here, any federal eyes, I think would be better than the kind of blatant, let's rip it away from Charlotte approach that's been taken so far by our new legislature.
And we're talking about close to about $6 to $7 billion that would be coming out of the coffers of this whole area down here. Is that correct?
Well, what you have $12 billion, which the airport does annually. But then as you talk about what could be happening in and around that area as we create an intermodal facility, that's another $9 billion, which would be real money to the citizens of Charlotte, because as it stands, of the $12 billion, the city of Charlotte taxpayer only receives $11 to $12 million of that. Only $11 to $12 million of a total of $12 billion. And that $11 to $12 million actually comes by way of the airport outsourcing fire and security, or I should say police services, from the city.
Well, you know,
we're talking about, I mean, this is a major asset. This is one of the things that drives me nuts. A lot of people, I heard, getting, quote unquote, tired of the yin yang back and forth with Raleigh, and just said, oh, what's the matter? A year or so back, but they rated it 23rd in the entire world.
Well, airport was business.
Airport. And, I mean, you're talking a major airport. I know it's not, you know, L.A., it's not Chicago or something, but it is, though, a major, major asset. And that is exactly why people, you know, reverse the question. Why is the legislature so hell-bent on getting it?
Oh, you think?
So it is a bomb that's being, you know, yanked right off the tree here. And I think people should pay attention. Seriously, what's going on?
Well, the only reason why it's being yanked away is because we have that puppet in Raleigh who's being run by Art Pope. Before, when he was mayor here, he was run by Duke Power. And because he didn't get elected twice when he ran, and he didn't get appointed to a federal job by the Bush administration, he is pissed at us. And he wants to, frankly, screw us.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I mean, it is a major asset for the city of Charlotte. And that is huge because, I mean, look, if they're going to go ahead and take it or attempt to take it, they ought to be paying the taxpayers for that asset over there, which nobody has talked about paying you a dime for it. But that's what they need to do. They need to be paying us for it if they really want to, you know, just call themselves coming in and ripping it away from us. Because, again, look, nothing has happened to really justify it. And really it was the way that it was done. It could have been done a little bit more professionally and not politically the way it has been handled. And, you know, it's just a shame that we are where we are because, you know, if we get caught up in years of a lawsuit, all that stuff I talked to you about with the intermodal facility, a lot of things could get hung up over there and nothing happens for the city. No jobs are created. No good roads are put into place. And that's a bad thing when we know right here, right now, we could use a pretty good shot in the arm relative to increasing our tax base and putting people back to work. And they will hold this up. They will hold that up from happening if this thing continues just to drag out like it is.
Exactly. And one of the, now this is to a broader point about the there's a Republican trend whenever they take to private time.
And reduce the tax base.
Examples of that we've seen in recent years are the ones like up north where they're doing this financial management. So they go in any community that's, you know, faltering in this poor economy, they take over. And as soon as they take over, what that really means is they sell off all the public assets, take everything away from them, and just take the profit.
Yeah.
It's like they just got the city, sell it off,
and then walk away, and all the their partners are all happy. And that's the down the road fear that I have for North Carolina with the way this Republican Congress is acting. I'm afraid that they're
regressive Congress.
They're trying desperately to take and extract wealth wherever they can find it in the state, and it worries me greatly. So that's the trend.
But that's the trend.
You know, the end result of all of that, once you've done enough damage, is then you have to, oh, you're in bankruptcy. Well, we'll have to step in and manage you. And you,
yeah.
You know, that's when you start dissolving government and start limiting the vote of the citizens. And it's a very dangerous path to start going down.
And another thing I like to talk about, and we're talking with the Mayor Pro Tem, Patrick Cannon here in Charlotte, North Carolina, who is a candidate for mayor.
That starts
September 6th, is that correct?
Early voting began August the 22nd, and it will continue through September the 7th. Primary election day is going to be Tuesday, September 10th, so that's going to be 2 weeks from Tuesday that's coming up. So it's right here and it's upon us today.
And so right here, can you also give us real quick your campaign website and a phone number, anything like that, that we can get out to people?
Absolutely. Certainly one can go to www.cannonformayor.com. That's cannonformayor.com. You can follow us on Twitter at cannonformayor.com. And also, when you do go to that website at cannonformayor.com, there's an ability for individuals to learn more about me, the candidate, what the issues are, and the leadership results that we have been about over the years. And if you care to volunteer or make any level of donation, we'd love to have your support as we move through this process. We have lots of folks already on board, but we could use more.
Well, I need to say that we extended an invitation to someone else in the city council is running, James Mitchell, and he has not called in today, so maybe we'll get a chance for him to call in next week. But well, one of the things that I'd like to say, we're here in Charlotte, I'll say one more time, here in Charlotte, North Carolina, with the present Mayor Pro Tem, Patrick Cannon, who is a candidate for mayor of this great city. I need to ask you one more, another thing that's been on my mind, that's on a lot of people's minds, and that's the Civilian Review Board. And I have two questions with that that really galls me. It's not a Civilian Review Board if the city council runs it. And what the hell is a, what's the other word, I can't remember what the heck the word is I'm thinking about. It's driving me crazy, but, anyway, why is it a Civilian Review Board when it's run by the city council?
Well, no, what happens is that the city council is supposed to make the appointments to the board. And the citizens, as we do, you know, the Airport Advisory Committee, as we do, the Planning Commission, as we do, the CRVA, et cetera, et cetera. And the citizens are to be appointed. And when a issue comes before that committee or that board, I should say, they in turn are supposed to weigh all of the evidence that comes before them and make a unbiased decision, only based upon the information which they receive. To date, the issue has been about having much more authority, such as subpoena power and the ability to go out and just check into other investigations and things of that nature, some of which, I might add, would require potential approval from the General Assembly. So when you start drilling down on what the ask is, keep in mind, this was the ask, all the things that are being asked for today in terms of the strengths that it should have, I produced back in the late 90s when I first brought it up. And when I brought it up in the 90s, the late 90s, it got voted down by the city council 9-2. I in turn found something within me because I refused just to give up on it because I knew that there was a need for it, brought it back. But when I brought it back, of course, it would have been under a different majority. The Republicans had the majority at that time, and they basically watered it down to something that many folks would have some concern about today. And, you know, they got rid of some of the things that people are asking for that I had originally brought to the table. So those requests are back before the council, a different council and different mayor, and it's in committee, and we're just looking forward to come out of committee with a recommendation of some sort in order for the council to move forward on.
Well, the thing was that I remember quite well, Mayor Fox instructed it was supposed to be a 90-day process. It's now like close to 150 days. That's one of the questions I'd like to ask, and I did remember what I wanted to ask. What the heck is a stakeholder? Every time I hear the word stakeholder, I think I'm at Aqueduct Racetrack. I mean, you know, the stakeholders are the citizens, period,
right.
Not the elected officials. How did that come about, the stakeholder?
You know, typically when you go through a study process of any type, you know, if it's transportation or transit, if it's consolidation, folks come back and they say they want to put together a blue ribbon committee, they want to put together a stakeholders group, which is supposed to mean those individuals who would have an interest in the subject matter, whatever it might be. And so that's how that came about. And in this case with the CRB, the Citizens Review Board, interviewed would have been citizens that are supposed to be your everyday citizens who may have an opinion about this one way or the other, for them to weigh in on it. And they also brought members of the police department in to gain their perspective to see what their thoughts about it happened to be, whether it was, you know, favorable, whether it needed to stay the same or, you know, not. And I believe that what the police chief has said at this juncture is that he feels like the way it's currently set up and structured, that it works for him. But at the end of the day, it's up to the city council and the mayor to make that level of determination, and that's where we are.
Well, you know, and I understand this, but the chief of police, he works for the city manager. The city manager works for the council, works for the city council. So
that's
the,
right.
A citizen review board needs to be made. I mean, I'm just going to give you a scenario, and I'd like you to tell me where you would like to change something. To me, a citizen review board should be a citizens-only review board, not elected officials, but policemen and citizens, or a complete citizens review board with someone at the head of it. Now, I think, realistically, that board, that citizen review board, should have, if you're going to have 10 people on it, you need 11 people on it for a vote, so you might have four policemen and the rest citizens. But the problem that we have is now the Citizens Review Board is absolutely worthless because in the final analysis, it don't matter what they say. The city manager has the final say. It doesn't matter what they say. That's why I think people are so upset because, and as we talked about this, you had, 1,500 complaints and you got five or six that go against the police department, nothing in life is 100%. So there's something wrong with this picture, and that's why I think a lot of people want this to change.
Well, keep something in mind. Before you had a little of something, you had nothing.
Right.
At least you're not in a place where you are having to start from scratch. But yet, you know, you always thought we do have something to work from, and I will tell you that during the time when motorists were being shot by the police, I, along with others, you know, couldn't really understand what sense it made for the police to be investigating themselves because there was no process. And, you know, you're asking the fox to guard the hen house, if you will, in that case. And so we did take that element away. But yet there's still more work to be done, in my opinion, and I believe we can get there. But during that time when those motorists were being shot and killed, there was a lot of unrest in this city, and we were almost a mini L.A. in the way of riots that were going to occur in our uptown, in any place else that people felt like they wanted to go into to damage to express their level of frustration. But I will tell you that at least bringing this about, it did calm the waters in terms of that not occurring. It did bring harmony to the community. It did put people's voice in the process, but it put it in a process that's not as strong as it could be or should be. And so that's the driver now in terms of, you know, folks wanting it to be stronger. I don't disagree with that. Again, I'm just waiting for it to come out of committee and not be filibustered or just tossed around here and there like a political football. Just bring it out. There's nothing political about it. Just bring it out, put it on the table because, again, you know, I'm thinking if there's going to have to be some approval coming out of Raleigh, chances are folks aren't going to get what they want.
Of course, you see, and see, this is, I mean, you know, it's like we're Mayberry. I mean, we can't do nothing. We are controlled by Raleigh. And if we're the 17th largest city in the United States, how the hell can that be? Why are we controlled? I mean, you know,
well,
if Charlotte, North Carolina, or Mecklenburg County, let's say, said, you know what, we're getting out of this. We're leaving this. We're going to create our own state. The rest of the state would go to hell in a handbasket. I mean, we are to Raleigh what New York City is to Albany. And people need to understand that. Right. Right. What do you think about that, Mayor Pro Tem?
Well, the way it is today, I mean, they are the sovereign. They hold the sledgehammer. We hold something much smaller, and they can rule the day, and they do rule the day. I can't begin to tell you about the number of issues that we may institute on the local level here that some will come back even in our own delegation and try to rip apart. And we only mean it for the good of our community, but they let us know that they control a lot of what goes on here. There needs to be a better working relationship, in my opinion, and we need to get beyond the politics and get and really deal with good, solid people issues, good, solid things that will move this city and this state forward. We'll be much better off. But when you start talking about what's happening with health care and education and voter ID type things, I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. There's a problem here. You know, when I leave North Carolina now, people ask me where I'm from. How happy do you think I am to say that I'm from North Carolina? And then when I do, they look at me cross-eyed and say, what are you folks doing there? Are you back in 1960-something, and prior? It just seems like that you all are moving backward and not forward. What is happening? So, you know, to be compared to a Mississippi back in the day is not good for North Carolina, nor is it for Charlotte.
My executive producer's from Mississippi.
Hey.
And
well, that's
he
all right.
Yep. Hey.
I immigrated to America years ago. it is a sad day when you can start saying, you know, hey, maybe things in Mississippi aren't so bad after all, just because we have put ourselves back into the Victorian era here. It's pretty amazing.
Well, would you not? You guys, go ahead.
I want to ask this because this is something that, you know, I listen to NPR all the time. I'm like my nerd. But they were talking extensively in the last few months about this, the vision plans that they got coming about Charlotte, what to do, when to do it, how to do it, you know, with our transportation and our development. It's been a lot of focus on South End recently, which, you know, whatever. But they're talking about redeveloping things and going forward. So I was really curious. We've talked about, you know, these things in the past and how to fix some things like the review board and all, but these, again, are things that, you know, you've already brought up over and over again. So just looking completely forward, I've heard these discussions, everything from, you know, putting a top on 277 and putting a park on it and developing shops along it and all that kind of stuff to,
a much better, much more robust transit system. I mean, our president had proposed to begin with linking, you know, Charlotte to New York City and everything else with high-speed rail. But, you know, we didn't fund that, so let's, you know, don't worry about that. But anyway, what is your vision, and what do you see us doing? I mean, if you were elected mayor, what's your idea of future Charlotte? What are your focus areas going to be?
Well, I would tell you that what's important to me is making sure that we create a balanced Charlotte. What that simply means is that no area throughout the city should be imbalanced from the rest. And so we know that those pockets can rest in the north, in some of our northern tiers, western, and even eastern portions of our city. And we need to make sure that we have leadership that is about making sure that there's a clear balance. Being one who actually got elected to a district seat back in 1993 when I was 26 for Midwest and Southwest Charlotte, it was one of the most downtrodden areas in the city of Charlotte. And it was the highest in crime. No job opportunities were available. The housing stock over there happened to be dilapidated and as worn and torn as you could possibly imagine. Road conditions weren't that bad, but we still had some areas that needed some improvement. And so I will tell you that balance is critical, and the things that I want to focus on and will focus on in terms of my vision is going to be economic development, because job creation and business development and moving some of those barriers to that don't allow job creation to take place is critical. Additionally, we need to reengage in more public-private partnerships again, because even though we are coming out of the recession, we're not completely out. Folks that are losing jobs today are not necessarily getting one on tomorrow, or cities are not in a position to do it all by themselves. So we're having to make sure, or we should be making sure, that we partner with people in the private sector to do some joint ventures to sort of take the pressure off both entities. The second area is going to be public safety. You know, you should feel safe in your neighborhood. You should be safe in the place in where you worship, and you should be safe in where you do business. And as chairman of community safety, I'm proud to say that we've gone and hired hundreds of police officers. We've gone out and reduced crime in historic low capacities. We've gone out and I've made sure that we voted to move forward having additional police divisions. Actually, six will be coming on tap soon and very soon. So that's important to me, especially specific areas like domestic violence. I'm a part of an entity called ENUGH. It's lowercase e, capital N, capital O, UGH. And it is the only entity that is not just an advocacy entity. Most domestic violence entities are more advocacy. This is prevention. And so it's important to me that the next mayor that moves, that comes forward, has a focal point on making sure that we do something to look at those numbers that suggest that every 7 seconds a woman is being abused, that changes. There's no place for that. And that also that we involve our youth in some area programs to give them some options as well. That can sort of go back to economic development. But there's also a piece in here, guys, where I instituted a cadet program. It's at UNC Charlotte, and it allows our young people to engage in finding out more about law enforcement. And once they go through this course, they have an opportunity to actually have a career in law enforcement. Now, I didn't say become a police officer per se, which is fine, but they have an opportunity in law enforcement. And sometimes people don't really know all of the different opportunities that exist in law enforcement. The other thing is housing. My vision is to make sure that veterans, the disabled, our seniors, our homeless, and even those that wish to afford market that can't afford market rate housing opportunities do have a chance to land housing that fits their budget. That's important. One, if we want to expand our tax base and make sure that everybody has a place that they can call home, we have to begin to start having some relationships with the county commission and the school board to get some of the county land that's out there donated to the city, or work with us through what I would characterize as being a land swap, or sell it to us for a very small fee so we in turn can go out there, or a small amount, so we in turn can go and provide this land to the builders who say they can't make any money off of affordable housing. That's just not true, because if we're able to do these land swaps where they have about 40-some-odd acres in and around some of these area schools, you can create developments like what we have at the park at Oaklawn, First Ward Place, Arbor Glen. These are areas where people pay rents between $75 and $1,600. They're all living together and raising their families and recreating, and the calls for 911 service don't exist, or at least we don't have tremendous calls coming from those areas. It can fit anywhere, whether it's a stable part of our community or an area where we're trying to reinvest. The last thing is just making sure that, from a visionary standpoint, we have a comprehensive transportation plan, good roads, sidewalks, providing bike lanes, and making sure that we have alternative modes of transit for people to be able to utilize to get to and from their destination, whether it's home, whether it's health care, whether it's school, wherever it might be. We want to make sure that people have options and opportunities to be able to take advantage of that. So I'm excited about the opportunity to be Charlotte's next mayor with the people's support. It's been a long time that I've been engaged in this community, and I've held the mayor pro tem title for probably 10 years now, five terms, and I'd be grateful to take the word pro tem off of the end of mayor pro tem.
Well, then let me ask you one thing, because I live on the east side. What do you perceive is going on with the Eastland Mall? I mean, I understand now they're going to give the, I guess his name is Hess, 6 months to develop a plan to make it a movie studio, which I would think would be great. What's your vision here at Fort Eastland Mall?
My vision would have been to have something similar to what I created over in my old district, City Council District 3, right at South Tryon and 485. It's called the Town of Arsley, or Arsley, some will pronounce it. It's a mixed-use development where people can rent. They can go from rental to ownership in the way of a home there. They can recreate because we got a YMCA in there. They can shop. They can dine. They can enjoy forms of entertainment because there's a movie theater also there. It's a robust area, and it stretches from South Tryon and 485 all the way down to Westinghouse Boulevard. Huge tract, nice piece of property. I was hoping that we could have done something similar to that site at Eastland Mall, because the vision has to be not what's just good for that site, but what will be good for that site that will have a ripple effect that goes on along Central Avenue, finds its way on over to Albemarle Road and places like that, Michael, where you know it needs a triple shot in the arm to revitalize those areas. So this proposal obviously is one that's on the table. It comes with a few of those things. It comes with an educational component. It does come with a residential component, and obviously, as you just said, it comes with this movie theater, not a movie theater, but this film studio component, right. And so, you got to figure out what comes first, though. And so my question has been in committee, by the way, I've moved to try to move this forward. I said okay, because I know that something is needed in the area, period. The question becomes, as I asked in committee a couple of weeks ago before we approved it, tell me about what's coming first with this chicken and egg piece. Is it the studio? Is it housing? Is it the education component, community component? What's it going to be? Because you have a lot of people out there that are very excited about this. But when you start talking about the phases of how this thing has to be put together, it's a big puzzle. It's a big puzzle. And I don't know that people understand that, you know, it could be 20 years. It could be 30. So I've asked them to come back and to at least give us what that looks like, because that's really important so that the community can know what they can expect and when they can expect it. Okay?
Well, we don't. And I think
it's just like when we dynamited the old Coliseum.
Right.
simultaneously be its own city state, and then the economy tanks.
Right.
Now it's been in limbo for years.
Yeah.
Right.
Slowly progressing, but again, you don't know all these phases and what's going.
Well, and I don't think the general public knows that it would take that long. They think this is going to be done overnight.
And yeah, and it's not.
And
it's
I have a book I can go to. I mean, don't act like that.
Yeah, and you got to know how much it's going to cost you. So we're waiting on even those numbers. How much is it going to cost? But let me tell you a bigger question. What will Raleigh say again?
Yeah.
What will the General Assembly say? Because here's the other question that I posed in our meeting, in our Economic Development Committee meeting. I said, look, and this was to Bert Hess, great guy. They're trying to do an awesome work. I get it. But I said, look, Bert, tell us, if you don't get these film incentives, okay, that the state has to put back in place, what does that mean for your project? What does it mean for the vision that you have? His words to me was that it dies. It's dead. So in as much as we're going to be going through this due diligence process to find out what their ask is, to determine the phases and other things, we don't know what's going to happen with these incentives, which, by the way, may not be even talked about until May of next year. So that means you're putting together, the city staff is putting together something. They're making sausage out of something, but they won't be able to deliver to us fully a full-cooked anything, because we'll have to wait and see what happens in Raleigh if they even take it up in May with these film incentives. But if they don't get those incentives, the whole thing is shot.
Well,
People don't know that.
This is very important. Now, North Carolina is one of the major film centers in this country now, and this rotten Art Pope run a government that we have in this state, because it's not run by Macquarie. Art Pope owns Macquarie, hook, line, and sinker, and they're trying to kill all movies in Charlotte. Like The Homeland is filmed, well, not just Charlotte, in North Carolina.
Yeah.
They're trying to kill Homeland right now. By taking away these incentives. So, you know, it's...
ideological components.
Right.
Certain things they said they didn't want to literally, quote, evil influence
right.
of liberal Hollywood here in North
Carolina. Right.
So there's that side of it. Yeah.
So, you know, no, you're absolutely right, and it'd be great if we had they killed the incentives up in, where's the film
Wilmington.
School? In Wilmington. That you're killing that. I mean, so, you know, you're right, and I think.
Is there a way for us to then, if say the incentives are killed in Raleigh, to go about it the opposite way, go through the film industry, go to Hollywood, go to New York, centers of it, and ask them to fund it into North Carolina, and they take investment in their industry.
They ain't gonna do that because they want the films in New York. They don't care about
that. It would develop Hollywood, you know, it would help. Now, is there a way to reverse engineer?
Well, you know, maybe the governor may have a different perspective on this, because I don't know if you all know, but you know, he was in the movie himself.
Did it fail?
In Nail. Back in, was that 1994? He was featured as an extra in that movie. So, you know, I don't know. I haven't heard him say that he's against it. In fact, I did get wind that there was going to be an aim to kind of put it back in. But who knows? I can tell you that one of the reasons that, you know, we had three entities that were looking to bid on this thing, and two bailed, one remaining, and it was suggested that the first one bailed because there was uncertainty about what would happen with these incentives. So I do hope that they will allow those incentives to be brought back into play, because it would mean North Carolina good. Forget politics. It would mean North Carolina good. It would mean people good. So hopefully they'll get down to the bottom of it and find a way to say, you know what, we understand, we get it, no politics here. Let's make this happen and call it a good day for North Carolina.
So playing devil's advocate, if the film incentives never come back, everything's destroyed, and this deal falls through, is there, you know, Eastland Plan B? What is that?
Eastland Plan B, my recommendation is that you call on some notable developers and ask them to engage in, you know, you almost have to cut your losses as a city. I mean, in other words, would we be willing to say, you know what, take the land, but have a good plan for it. Let us see it. You can let the market drive it, but don't come back to the city to ask for any additional dollars for it, because that is a mammoth of a project. The persons now looking to do it will have to come back for some dollars. I know that, but it's going to be more through tax increment financing, TIF. So they would say that's not direct monies coming from the city. It's something else. And so, but I know that in order to make it happen, they would have to get tax increment financing on that deal to make it come into fruition. So the thought could be that you find somebody out there in the private sector who's willing to come in and to develop it. The question becomes, what would that be, though? Because the market has to be right for it. And what I don't want to have is somebody land banking on it. But at the same time, you nor I or anybody else is going to build something that will not, you know, allow people to come in and to patronize it, whether it's residential, commercial, retail, what have you.
Right. Gets back to your original idea of everything in balance.
I want to thank you for taking the time, Your Honor, and I would
thank
like you.
You
to act. I want you to have a great Labor Day, and I'd really like to have you come back on next week. Well, because when does the vote is September 10th, right? Tuesday.
Yeah, Tuesday, September 10th is primary election day. Libraries will open up on September the 3rd. If people want to sort of get ahead of any crowd, potential crowd that may come, if you think a crowd's going to be there. So certainly you can go to www.mecboe.org. That's mecboe.org, and that will give you a listing of all the different locations as to where one can go to vote. If you got any questions about being able to vote, 704-336-2133.
And give us your website one more time.
All right. It's www.cannonformayor.com. Again, www.cannonformayor.com. And a good phone number, say if you're out of the city or in the city, you can call us at 855-451-2266. Again, 855-451-2266. Thank you.
I want to thank you. That's Mayor Pro Tem Patrick Cannon, who is running to be the next mayor of the, well, they used to say the great state, or am I going to say the great state of Charlotte,
no,
North Carolina?
No, don't say that, man. No, just the city of Charlotte. That's it.
The city of Charlotte. We had the convention here. We
Indeed.
Are doing, and we will do better with a mayor that knows what they're talking about. Okay, thank you.
Thank you guys so much. Have a great day and good holiday.
You too. Bye-bye. That was the Mayor Pro Tem, Patrick Cannon. Right now, we have someone who I'd like to bring up, if he's still there. He has been holding on a long time. Matt Newton, are you there?
Yes, Michael, I'm still here.
Oh, you are there. Oh.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Matt Newton is, well, explain us to the listening audience who you are, Matt.
I am a Charlotte attorney. I have my own law firm, myself and another attorney, Tiffany Arroyo. It's Newton and Arroyo, PLLC. We have a website, newtonarroyolaw.com, and we do just about everything. And I've been spending a lot of extracurricular time lately working on the Citizens Review Board issue.
Okay. And were you at the we just talked to the Mayor Pro Tem about that, but you were at the last meeting of the City Council. I was there also. And tell us some of your thoughts.
Last Monday. And there was a contingent of Citizens Review Board reformers there in support of a number of speakers. I was the first speaker. And we were there to comment on the proceedings of the prior week committee meeting that was considering the issue.
Mm-hmm. And what did you understand from that meeting?
Well, the outcome of that particular meeting was referring the issue back to a task force that had been assembled by the city for its recommendations, which will then come back before the committee. Our concern is we have completed, for all intents and purposes, under the guidelines established by Mayor Fox, we've completed the stakeholder process, and we've discussed what a stakeholder is. Let's be blunt about this. Stakeholders.
I worry. Stakeholder. Knife in my back every time I hear that word. Stakeholder. Jesus, I'm looking at the racetrack right now. Holy cow! Go ahead.
Yes. Let's make it. Let's just make it simple and say it's the community. Whether that be citizens or interested organizations, including the police department. In my case, a coalition of community organizations, including the ACLU, the NAACP, A. Philip Randolph Institute, and so forth. We have come together. We have proposed our own recommendations, and unfortunately, for the sake of the committee meeting, those recommendations weren't enough.
Mm-hmm. What were some of those recommendations?
It's pretty straightforward, and I think that the Mayor Pro Tem touched on this. I wanted to mention that we do have a 9-2 split, Democrat to Republican now on City Council, so it makes it that much more frustrating having a delay like we have. This isn't 1996 right now. We have the exact opposite composition. And so I would have thought that the issue would have not just been handled in a much more expedient fashion, but that some of the members of City Council would be more up to speed. But having said that, we are where we are. And our recommendations consist of subpoena power. We're asking that there be a shorter period of time for appeals. We're asking that citizens be given some help throughout the process. That currently is not the case. We're asking for more broader, I guess might be the best way of putting it, internal disclosures between the police department and the review board itself. We're asking for transparency of the board. We would like to know who's on the board and what they're currently doing. We're also asking what the standard of
this board. I understand this board is more secretive than the FISA court.
Yeah. I believe so. We still don't. You know, the law school, the Charlotte School of Law, they instituted a Freedom of Information Act request. And I had contacted them last week, and we work closely in conjunction with the law school. And they had told me that they did receive information on who's been on the board in the past, but even themselves, they cannot tell us right now who's currently on the board. And certainly from the standpoint of accountability, that's an issue.
But why is that? Why can't they tell you who's on the board? As a matter of fact, who are the people or the person, since this is more secretive than the FISA court, that knows everybody that's on the board?
Well, I would imagine it's the city manager's office and all the incremental agencies that work with underneath the city manager, most certainly the Community Relations Committee. And so that's who, it's my understanding, that's who these Freedom of Information Act requests are addressed to, and that's who responds.
So
But now I don't understand because I'm just a very simple person and believe in, like, you know, transparency, and that's why I used to love Florida. I used to have the Sunshine Law. I thought that was the best named, easiest law in all of history. And of course, you know,
well, we have a
Bush revoked that one when he was governor. But why can't we know who's on a citizen?
Well, I'm going to tell you right now. Just listen. Just listen.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
So, is the city manager the shadow?
Well, you know,
I'm asking Matt. Is that is that true?
I believe the city manager has an awful lot of power within the city of Charlotte. And in this particular instance, and I can't speak for every issue, but in this particular instance, I would be shocked if the city manager did not know who was on the board. But certainly, I think in the vast majority of citizens' review boards across the entire country, and even review boards here in our own state, and you can jump online, you can type in Winston-Salem Citizens Review Board, for example, and you will be able online to pull up the names of the individuals on the board. We unfortunately don't have that in Charlotte, and we also don't have the ability to just pull up general information. Go ahead, Michael, I'm sorry.
Why do we know why?
There's no explanation. I think the simple answer is that it's not written within the ordinance that controls what the Citizens Review Board does. If it's in writing within an ordinance, then there's no option, right? They have to abide by the ordinance and be more transparent.
Well, but if you have to go with a Freedom of Information Act, there's something wrong with this picture.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like because it doesn't specifically state that they have to put their right on a website, they're hiding behind it.
Right.
Well, then you can never know.
If I don't specifically take the garbage out, it's going to be in my lap in my bed because my wife's going to put it there if I'm sleeping.
Yep.
So there are some things that you're supposed to do, and you shouldn't have to have somebody go to a court to find out what it is.
And this is what I got.
I agree. I think the contention that we have to go to Raleigh, knock on the door and ask for their approval, I'm not on board with that. You know, I think that it's important to draw a distinction between this.
But if that's the case, Matt, because the Mayor Pro Tem Cannon said that, you know, some of the things we have to, because we are controlled by Raleigh. You know, this is Mayberry, I guess. I mean, you know, no big city has access to their state capital. That's not done. Maybe we need to stop having a city council and a county commission, and we need to have one group of 15 people that's a city council run by a president and a mayor who's a strong president that controls everything, and when things don't go wrong, we hang him and we hang the city council. I mean, we can't operate like we are in Mayberry. This is childish. We got to answer to Raleigh. We may not be able to do this. What kind of nonsense is this? I mean, this is nonsense.
We're being told, Michael, is that we shouldn't institute what's right because we're afraid of what Raleigh might say. And it's a mentality of fear. I think that it's important that we draw a distinction between issues where Raleigh does have a say and others where they don't. When it comes to East Lamar, for example, we're talking about whether or not Raleigh is going to give tax breaks to business. That's not what we're talking about in the instance of the Citizens Review Board. Let's be clear about this. The Citizens Review Board has something, it's something that's already been approved on the state level. We have multiple Citizens Review Boards across the entire state. And I think to say that the state is going to pluck the guitar strings here after the guitar has already been made is ridiculous. Certainly after the fact, if they want to go as far as to draft a particular law specifically outlawing things like subpoena power on Citizens Review Board, I assume they have the power to do that. But it doesn't mean that for the time being we shouldn't do the right thing and create a real, effective, meaningful Citizens Review Board.
Well, the fact is that if Riley, you say, is it written anywhere that Riley has the power to prevent us when a Citizen Review Board from getting subpoena power? Is that written anywhere?
Not in my opinion, no, I haven't seen it. And the particular statute, which is 160A-168, that's the personal record statute. You can go online, type in North Carolina General Assembly, and look at state statutes. 160A-168 doesn't prevent us from doing this. It's a mentality, as I was saying before. Well, it's an excuse, is what it is, in my opinion, and it shouldn't be a reason for us not to act in the instance when what we're accomplishing is the right thing. Now, certainly under the basic system of checks and balances, Riley can write laws, but having to obtain their approval beforehand, ridiculous.
Well, I wouldn't pass anything that this corrupt, regressive Art Pope run state wouldn't do. And I think they're so upset with Mecklenburg County because we are democratic in a sea of red ink, or democratic in a sea of red other counties, especially that Union County. I mean, they might just do that just for spite.
They may, but it's like the mayor pro tem was saying. You know, there are a number of issues that have been instituted on a local level, and this is quoting Mayor pro tem Patrick Cannon from a second ago. There are a number of issues instituted on a local level that may be ripped apart by Riley, right? But it didn't mean that they shouldn't have been instituted in the first place. What we're facing right now is the contention or the proposition or the mentality that we shouldn't institute a stronger Citizens Review Board in the first place because of a fear of what Riley might do. Well, why is there a difference now for this particular issue is the question.
Well, I would say you're absolutely correct, but because we have presently a servant governor who he believes was wronged by the people of Charlotte, I would not put anything past him. And, you know, and people could say, well, you got to give him a break. No, we don't have to give him a break. You know, he wants to take credit for things that happened in this state, in this county, and this city when he was the mayor for so long. He was a mayor on a Democratic city council and county commissioners. He had no choice. So nothing that was done here, I give him credit for. Nothing. And the problem is that he's trying to be up there. Riley says, well, I did this and I did this. He did absolutely squat. So I wouldn't put it past them in 1 minute that they wouldn't try to do everything in their power to kill everything in this city. And just like Thomas was saying, they just might want to make this city go bankrupt so they could send in a person to take over. I mean, these Republican governors have been doing it all across the states. Why not here? So, you know, I think the fact is that the main fact with the Supreme Review Board, as I look at it, is they don't have subpoena power. Okay, that's one thing. But they don't, you know, when something happens, they get a version of what happens from the police, not a version for what happened from the actual report. That's the main thing. I think if that was done, I think we should be a lot in this era and this atmosphere would mean a lot if we just were able to get the absolute version when the police got it and when we got it, and not the version that the police, and I'm not saying anything about the police commissioner, or I mean the police chief or anything else. They are hardworking citizens, not saying that they would change it, but we need to have the correct and the exact thing that was given to the police when the report was made.
Yeah, I think that the board, they need to have the opportunity, if necessary, to make a fully educated decision. And
absolutely,
at this particular moment, that's not the case. They're only required to be given a short summary of the police internal affairs review and nothing more. Now, it's my understanding that the chief of police, Rodney Monroe, has taken efforts along with his internal affairs division to provide more information than just a summary, and I applaud them for that. However,
absolutely,
we don't know. You know, we don't know if that's going to be the case forever, right? And there need to be procedural measures in place to address an instance whereby the board isn't given the information they feel like they are required. They're required to make a fully informed decision. And that's not the case now, and I certainly hope that the discussion isn't one that is steered away from that because of potential internal disclosures that are made at this present time without considering the possible shortcomings of the future. I think that's even more reason to expand those disclosures, whether it be through the institution of subpoena power or not. We have a board that has to sign a confidentiality agreement before even sitting on the board, and they also have to undergo Citizens Academy training. So we should trust them with the information. We should trust them with the ability to make the right decision. And under the current process, and also the ability to make an effective decision. I think you touched on this earlier, Michael. Even if they were to decide in a way that is contrary to the police department, this is something that is still subject to the review of the chief of police and the city manager. So these are all issues that I think we need to look at, and we need to change the way that they're instituted and implemented if we want to have a real, as you would put it, a real citizens review board that isn't Mayberry.
Right. Well, you know, and the thing is that, you know, we're sending these people for training to get, when they get the information from IA, to understand it. We don't send jurors to jury school.
Right.
We pick them off the street. Hey, buddy, we sent a letter to your house. Get in here. And now you got to make a decision whether this guy should be given lethal injection, hung, shot, or quartered. I mean, what are you kidding me?
Well, I think one of the problems and one of the solutions is the transparency.
Right.
If you can see and know who's on the board, just like you can go to court and see the jurors.
Absolutely.
You get to hear the case just like they do. If there were some time, and it doesn't have to be completely, say there's a sensitive issue, I understand, you know, the public just can't be wandering.
Right.
Saying, there are code machines, you know, I don't know. But if there was simple accountability, people could see who was on the board and to at least know the cases and things in a general way of what's being presented, a lot of it would take care of itself.
Absolutely.
Because they would have, they would literally have the public looking over their shoulder.
Absolutely.
And you could have shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
And shenanigans always exist when they're festering in the dark.
Absolutely.
That's when problems come. And that's what this is supposedly the solution to.
Right.
So that, you know, when the police department does something on the shady side or whatever, it can be reviewed in the public light of day by the citizens and shown to be correct or not. That's the point, supposedly. And yet, now we're putting this in target. That's what's troubling.
Yeah, well, and you know, and I believe Rodney Moore is a great chief of police. But Rodney Moore works for the county manager. And he works for the council. So, therefore, Rodney Moore isn't even in this mix.
Well, no, but
I mean, because 99 and 44, 100% of the policemen we have on duty in this city are fabulous. Are fabulous. They do a great job. So it's not nothing about them.
No, but this is, it's supposed to be an outside entity.
Right.
Can't have in any entity.
Right. Any entity.
The police.
Right. Well, that's what the Mayor Pro Tem Patrick Cannon said. It should be a independent board. So, my final question to you, Matthew, is how do we get an independent body, an independent board?
Function.
Our coalition group has proposed 9 specific changes to not only increase the transparency of the board, but also ensure that it has independent decision-making authority and real decision-making power. It's a matter, and the Mayor Pro Tem hit on this earlier, it's a matter of getting this through committee and back to the floor of City Council. We have taken painstaking efforts to ensure that happened. The community has spoken. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Our concern as of 2 weeks ago and what we brought to the floor of City Council this past Monday was that community voice could potentially be undermined at this point. The task force is a group of community relations committee members along with one-third of the Citizens Review Board, so not even half, one-third of these folks that has been handpicked by the executive director of the Community Relations Committee, who answers directly to the city manager. So handpicked by the city. And they now have an opportunity that wasn't afforded by the original guidelines. So we're talking about changing the rules of the game, right, halfway, if not more than halfway through. They're being afforded an opportunity to make their own independent recommendations, despite the recommendations of the police department, Charlotte School of Law, our community organizations and community citizens, and it's our fear that the recommendations will conflict with those that have been proposed, and that is what this committee will run with. We asked on this past Monday that the city council keep us in the loop, not elbow us out, and once again to please review the reports that have been given to them on numerous occasions. You can go on crbreform.com, look at the Community Coalition Group report, read the first 13 pages, and it is abundantly clear as to what the problem is and what the solutions are. And it's a matter of having committee members, and this is the Council Manager Committee, jump on board, propose these, get them cleared through the City Attorney and to the floor of City Council for final approval.
Well, I would just, if someone wanted to get in contact with you, Matt, and find out more about this, how can they do that?
We have a link on our website where folks can click and write an email to us. We can also be contacted on our Facebook page, that's CRB Reform Now, CRB Reform Now. If anyone wishes to contact me directly, I ask that you please send an email to my law firm, and that is Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, Arroyo, A-R-R-O-Y-O, law, @yahoo.com.
I want to thank you, Matt, and I want you and your partner to have a great
Labor Day.
See, I didn't have 4th of July because I was sick. So that's what I'm saying. I'm behind you. Yeah, it's all mine.
Thank you.
But have a great
Labor
Day. Okay? And we will talk to you very soon.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Matt.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Have a great Labor Day, too.
Oh, thank you. That's
Bye.
Really running and helping this community to find out why the Citizen Review Board is not working like it should. And he's helping to produce or helping to straighten out that problem. And I think we're well on our way. He's talked about a lot of things that needs to be done with the Citizen Review Board. And I really appreciate what he's done.
Absolutely. Well, you know,
That's why we're here, Mike.
Well, you know, we have about another 8 or 9 minutes here, so. And I want to bring up a couple of things here.
Well, let me whip out our 500 pages of
backlog. Five of backlog.
We haven't been over.
We got
here.
Stuff backlog that we haven't eaten. Hey, how about these moronic imbeciles, conservative? Now, see, not all conservatives are imbeciles. But the ones on radio and television are.
Let me check. Hold on.
Well, can you check?
No, I think you're absolutely wrong.
I'm sorry. But not one of these regressive party elected officials came to the 50th anniversary of the Martin Luther King speech and
let's say that again.
March.
How many?
Not a zero. Not a zippo.
And by the way.
And you know what they said?
Really ironic.
Yes.
You said not a. Oh. Talking about these.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's true.
That's
true.
Funny. Well, anyway,
they all said, well, I know anything about it. You had Rush Limbaugh saying, none of them were about it. You had that moron O'Reilly saying, it's a disgrace. It's a disgrace that none of them were invited.
50 years, you don't say.
Well, you know what? They're lying. They lie. You know what? You can tell when these people are lying. They're moving their mouth. They're moving their mouth.
I can guarantee. Look, if it was the 50th anniversary of Ronnie falling off his horse or something, they'd all be standing around.
Still trying to pick him up when he's been in the ground for 40 years.
So,
yeah,
I mean,
well. The thing is, they all said they weren't invited. Well, the next day, it came out that every one of these moo-moos were invited.
Yep.
And they all said, I'm doing an NRA fundraiser down in Buenos Aires. And Boehner, Uncle Boehner. Let me tell you what Uncle Boehner said. He said, I'm worried about the strike. What's the president going to do about that? I want the legal justification for any military strike. I want the policy and precedents, such as the response. What response would it take? And I want to know the objectives of any strategies for any action. And I want to know that's what I want to know. But, you know, he didn't say that. He had his dummy, Brendan Buck, say that for him.
A spokesperson.
Supposedly.
You can't say, well, he didn't.
Right. I didn't actually ask him to say that. Of course.
They say something, and then they say,
and then they said, well, you know what? The only black conservative in the Senate was not asked. They were moving their lips again. The call was read on the air. He was called and sent a letter, and he said, nada, zippo.
Look, they have, I think it's absolutely telling, and I think it's, there was something I read just a while back. But it said they have move beyond being embarrassed or shy about being.
There was something written, I believe it was in the Huffington Post, and it says, a party full of radio clowns, GOPs flip the bird to racial justice. I mean, they don't care about Jack. They don't care about Jack. Now,
right.
What can I say? And they also, if I could find this piece in here, and I thought I had it, so I have to go look on the page here. Nope, I don't have it there. But anyway, they don't care about the black vote.
Well, here's let's read this little article.
Right.
The opening paragraph alone will see it.
Oh, okay. All right. Read the article there.
Says, this is a party full of radio clowns, GOP, the bird.
Oh, yeah. Right, right.
Well, Republicans haven't been truly competitive for the African-American vote since Richard Nixon got a third of black voters in 1960 against JFK,
right,
who spent most of that campaign hedging his bets on civil rights. But after that, the party of Lincoln actively drove black people from their ranks into the Democrats. The testimony of black Republicans who were sidelined, excluded, and even attacked at the 1964 GOP convention in San Francisco when the party nominated the anti-civil rights Barry Goldwater is very painful to read. But in the post-Reagan years, however, Republicans have been more careful about blatantly spurning the support of African Americans, mainly because of an image of racial tolerance, at least was deemed essential to gaining the support of white moderates and independents. Soccer moms, have said, didn't like it when you were overtly racist.
Ooh.
Right? See, they've just given, they don't care anymore. And it goes on and just says how in time they've just washed their hair the whole thing and said now they don't care. They're just flat out. They know they don't have anything to lose with their hardcore voters.
Of course not.
They don't even try or pretend that. So they don't show up. They don't support. You know, they openly boo the president when he speaks. You know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
What was that? I think Bush ran and got, well, Bush's daddy got 44% of the black vote, and I think the dummy Romney got 7%.
Well, you know.
Not even 47. 7?
There's a wise man that you might have right here on the
wise man?
Front of the page.
Oh.
And it says, that you may have heard of him, because he was speaking this week again on TV.
Was he moving his mouth?
It's Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, okay.
They played a couple of his little speeches.
Yes, uh-huh.
But he said this little thing that the Republicans might be interested in, because it applies to all of us. It says, we all may have come on different ships to America, but we're all in the same boat now.
Oh.
And that's what I don't understand about these guys.
In the same boat.
If you're,
are there enough life rafts?
You know, look, if you keep gutting the country and you keep destroying the economy and you keep blasting apart our families and our neighborhoods and you depress entire segments of the society because of their skin or because of their origin or because they happen to have spoken another language, you know, before English, you're destroying America. You know, we're all in this together. And you can't just say, well, we're going to just destroy Detroit. That won't really matter. And we're going to just destroy New Orleans. That won't really matter.
No.
You know, we're going to just stop voting in the South. That won't really matter. You know, it does. And it takes the entire country down.
Just
like they knocked their AAA rating down when they did the last.
Who cares about ratings?
You know, the last time. When they
I got my bonds. They're off. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. They're in the Cayman Islands. Well, now, you know, here we are going back to that again. But again, it affects all of us.
Well,
we're in the same boat.
Yeah, same boat. Hey, but listen, you got to remember, when he asked the Boner Man, he would say, Wyoming. As it says in the article, washing his hair. No, he was in the sixth whitest state in the U.S.
Sixth whitest.
And he couldn't make it. Majority Leader Eric Cantor, who traveled to Selma with Representative John Lewis last year, was likewise engaged someplace else. Both President Bush recuperating. Now, we understand that. They couldn't come. Jeb Bush, though, who was invited by his father for to take the place of him, he had other plans. And John McCain just said, no. But he's all about sending those troops to
Let's get in there and kill them Syrians. Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's whack them over the head. That's what they deserve. That's another guy. If I was president, we'd be at war every day. As a matter of fact, we'd be building spaceships, going to Mars and fighting them.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, I mean, what's a good war?
Hey, all war all the time.
He said, after all, I'm the one that almost blew up the whole ship that I was on, firing the missile when I got in the aircraft. I mean, the aircraft, I mean, you know, how did I know that that was a button that fires a missile? I was only a pilot. But anyway, getting back to the other things that are on our mind today, there was, how about the NSA? They got the movie out, Closed Circuit. How about if we were like that? 525,000 cameras in one city.
Yeah, but,
525,000 cameras. We don't need that because we got satellites spying on us. We got satellites. All right, point to that guy down there. Okay, what's he? What underwear is he? He's not wearing underwear. Let's take him. Put him overseas. Rendition.
Well, we don't have to have 500,000 cameras on us because, unfortunately, we all have
cell phones
and everything else. We're watching
this.
They're tracking this real time. Yeah. They don't even have to move the camera. You know, we walk around.
Well, did you ever see the commercial with Alec Baldwin?
They don't understand that we're in the restaurant
right
at that moment.
Right.
We take a picture of it.
Oh, yeah.
Just want a meeting and then post it to Facebook.
Right, yeah, there it is. You know, it's just like the commercial, Alec Baldwin. He's tied. And he says, Mr. Baldwin, do you have any last requests? Yes, I'd like to redeem some of my venture lines. Oh, yeah. Takes out. Looks like, oh, that's really good. I like that. See, if you like that, press that red button there. Bam. He says, now, how come he didn't get that? Well, it's because we're in the same boat.
Yeah.
We're all in the same boat now.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And just hoping it's not named Titanic.
And I hope that down in the hold, there's no room 101.
You know what I'm saying? Ooh, room 101. Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen.
That's all the Orwellian humor we have
That's
today.
All the Orwellian humor we have today. It's been a wonderful. I'm going to have some apple pie.
Ooh.
How about you?
I think I'll join you in that.
Okay.
I have never
drank
a better dessert.
Hey,
you have.
Got that. Got that right. Well, everybody, have a great, great, great 4th of July.
It is not.
I mean, what am I keep saying? For? See, I missed that. I was sick at the time. I haven't had any apple pie yet. Labor Day. Sorry. I've been brainwashed.
Yeah, see, he's already forgetting
the word. I'm only forgetting.
That's
day.
Like, hey, this is actually, and remember what this day is for, people.
Yeah.
Enjoy the weekend, you know, watch a game, drink beer, do whatever, but also
Labor Day.
Remember what it's for.
Labor.
Yep.
Labor. Fight for that $15 an hour.
Oh, did you see that article the other day?
Yeah.
Now, they did try. If minimum wage had been linked to.
Oh, it'd be 22.
Today, today it would be $28.75. $28.75 would be the equal pay we would get.
There would be one person in Burger King answering the window saying, hello, where you are? Wait a minute. Okay, I'll be right with you. Let me put them burgers on. Let me put the fries on. Okay, you got it. An hour later, you get your fries. French. Oh, it's wrong? You want a double with cheese and bacon?
And they'd be healthier. Look at how that works
out. I'm telling you, it works out great. Okay.
All right, everybody.
Goodbye. Have a great Labor Day.